Welcome to How We Run, a podcast where we examine how nonprofits become successful. I'm Trent Stamp, CEO of the Eisner Foundation.
And I'm Julie Lackacher, founder of Good Ways, Inc. This episode features David Diaz, the executive director of Active San Gabriel Valley. He speaks with us about transitioning his organization from a fiscal sponsor to an independent 501c3 and all the work he's doing on collaborative decision-making and culture to retain and support his staff. Trent, do you all fund organizations that are with fiscal sponsors?
To tell you the honest truth, Julie, we try not to. Just because it adds another layer. Usually there's a cut that has to come through that goes to someone other than the organization we're funding. I know in some cases, and we have had some grantees where it's necessary, small organizations, fledgling organizations. I prefer that organizations bring as much in-house as they possibly can. It sets up a level of accountability and transparency that we're usually more comfortable with if we know that when we want to support an organization, we write a check to that particular organization. It's not perfect, but generally we stay away from organizations with fiscal sponsor.
I genuinely didn't know that, and I feel bad about not knowing it because I've talked to you for like 25 hours on this podcast. So
it's not a hard and fast rule. We're a family foundation, and we change based on if we really trust the person or if there's a compelling reason for it. But I will say that when it comes to evaluation time, it generally is a strike against you when you're being evaluated by the Eisner Foundation, not any other foundation, just us.
And I'm curious, can you elaborate on that? What's the difference between an organization that's fiscally sponsored and one that's not?
It just introduces another organization into the dynamic that I haven't evaluated. Because when I go to make a gift to an organization, I know who's on their board. I know who their accountant is. I know their CFO, their COO. I know who their staff is. I know who their constituents are. If I'm going to make a gift to an organization with a fiscal sponsor, do I now have to evaluate that level of the organization also? Do I have to now run the board of the fiscal sponsor through our metrics? It's just another level of evaluation, another level of that reduces my transparency and my accountability with the organization. Again, there are perfectly normal reasons for it, but it's just something that I'm not as comfortable with it as many other foundations are.
I know from my point of view, what I usually see with organizations that are fiscally sponsored is that with donor relations, it can be harder to get the information faster about who donated and when the letter go out. It can make it just a little bit of a slower reporting system in terms of donor lists and stuff like that.
I just like to know if I have a question or a concern, who do I call? And sometimes that gets a little confusing. If I can keep it simple, I prefer to.
Right. So I got a chance to talk to David Diaz, who runs Active San Gabriel, which is a tremendous organization in that the thing that they're trying to do is so complicated. And he mentioned that they are transitioning from a fiscal sponsor to be their own independent 501c3. I think they're 4 months into it. And so we started talking about one thing, and then I think that we really got some details on making that transition. And it was fascinating to hear about all the due diligence he's done as the leader of that organization to make that possible. It really is a big change.
It is. I think it's a natural evolution for most organizations. If you think of your larger, more corporately kind of nonprofits, very few of them have fiscal sponsors, right? It's for fledgling organizations. It's for grassroots organizations who don't necessarily want to have that kind of back office on staff, who haven't really put those kind of processes in place for the kinds of things that they're trying to do. But I don't know a ton of organizations that are 10, 15, 20 years old who still have a fiscal sponsor.
It is a great tool, though, for some of the new organizations and some of the more grassroots organizations, as you said. The other thing he's talking about, as a small organization, how hard he works to take care of his people there to prevent burnout. And I know that you and I have talked a couple of times about what it's like from a funder point of view when you're getting high turnover at an organization. So it was really interesting to hear him talk about what he's doing to retain staff and how he's taking care of his people.
It's hard in normal circumstances, right? I mean, generally in the nonprofit world, you're going to make a little less money than you might have made in a different sector. But if you get to the point where you're working just as hard, if not harder, for not enough money in a difficult, challenging environment where you're not as appreciated, it's just human nature. It's part of this great resignation. So I really commend CEOs, executive directors for finding ways to support their staff. We always talk about it when we make a grant at the foundation, which is, what are you doing to keep your good people? What are you doing to retain your people? What are you doing to support them? I think it's perfectly fine to talk about how you have a good leave policy. You've done things for people, some team building around the office, if that's what people are interested in. Make sure you have good coffee. Make sure you do what you can to get people good parking spots and leave them alone on the weekends if that's not part of their job. But don't send people texts and emails at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon or 10 o'clock on Thursday night. Let them have a life and support them because you need them in your field.
That's so good to hear you're using that as part of the evaluation.
Oh, absolutely. Because so many of these nonprofits are just personnel heavy, right? The product that they provide is hard to differentiate from that of their peers. And when organizations are great, it's usually because they have great people. So hopefully you're doing what you can to retain, recruit, support those people, because if you lose your good folks, you're destined for failure in the sector.
I think that's the thing to listen to in this interview with David. He has some really great tactical things he's doing. So let's take a listen.
My name is David Diaz, Executive Director of Active San Gabriel Valley. Our mission is to create a more sustainable, equitable, and livable San Gabriel Valley.
You know, the first reason I wanted to talk to you is because I know you're a fellow in the John W. Mack Movement Building Program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So I am a fellow currently. It's an opportunity for myself and other leaders from in and around the LA area and other places as well to have an opportunity to connect with one another as folks that are in leadership positions. Sometimes being in a leadership role does feel relatively lonely at times. And so this is an opportunity for folks in leadership positions or executive directors to learn and talk amongst each other, to learn from each other, to learn from others, to be able to continue doing the movement building work in their respective communities.
That's wonderful. What have you learned from your peers? Because I think you're right. It is lonely at the top. And sometimes you want to bounce ideas off of someone else that understands. So what have you learned?
One thing from talking to someone at another organization that I learned and have adopted into our organization, which is the 40-hour rule. Essentially, you give folks 40 hours, right? So that could be 5 business days or 5 days to be able to uplift a concern or something that folks may have had issue with that may affect the interpersonal relationship amongst colleagues. And so I think one of the things that I appreciate a lot individually and professionally is the ability to be able to have conflict resolution, because if it's not resolved, it can lead to tension, miscommunication, and things you wouldn't want to see come up in your organization. Interpersonal conflict is one of the things that comes up a lot. We created a standard operating procedure around how to call people in, how to address it, along with the framework for folks to follow.
When do you use the 40-hour rule? Tell me how you present it to staff.
For example, let's say you felt that I called you out indirectly or directly during a meeting or something, right? And that didn't sit well with me, the impact of what you said or what you didn't sit well with me. And we've developed a process where the 40-hour rule, where we want folks to be able to have conflict resolution with each other. And so this process basically means that either you resolve it within those 40 hours. If you don't resolve it, if you don't bring people in or you don't talk about it, then let it go, because we don't want that tension to build over time.
Got it.
So you can't 2 years later say, I remember this one time at this meeting, you said this led to that, right? It's a way for people to be able to resolve a conflict that may come up. And this can happen in smaller, big ways. It doesn't include things like major things like sexual harassment, bullying, and other more serious things. Those are all going to go to human resources. Things that may have had an impact on folks negatively that they can resolve amongst each other.
I think what that does, and where I see that being very effective, is that one is, I think sometimes things interpersonally at work can eat at you. And then you think, oh, I should have addressed it in the moment, but I lost that opportunity. So you said 5 days. You have a choice. It's still open to talk about, but you have a timeline there. And if you can't bring it up in 5 days, then you should move on. So it's for those littler interpersonal conflicts. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And folks also have an opportunity to bring in someone like their project manager or the executive director, if they feel more comfortable having that conversation with someone there, or if they can resolve it themselves, they can do so. There's different opportunities for them to do that.
That's great. And you learned that in the fellows program. You got that from another leader. I don't want to give folks the impression that y'all are fighting a lot over there. Tell us a little bit about Active San Gabriel Valley.
Yeah, our mission is to create a more sustainable, equitable, livable San Gabriel Valley. If you're not from LA or the LA region, we focus on Eastern Los Angeles County, which is comprised of 31 cities and 4 large unincorporated areas, roughly about 2 million people. It's a very diverse set of neighborhoods. And so we really want to create a participatory, equitable process for public funding to address the multiple needs in our area around active transportation, climate, as well as other sustainability or climate related things in the area. We've been around for 10 years. We're going on 11 years. We recently transitioned from a fiscally sponsored project. So we are formally fiscally sponsored as of last fiscal year. So as of this fiscal year, we're now our own independent 501c3. So we're coming up on almost 4 months of being in our own independent 501c3.
Oh, excellent. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It's not a process that I advise folks to go through, especially when you have multiple contracts to transfer from your fiscally sponsored, from your fiscal sponsor to your organization. It's just a tremendous undertaking. So I definitely don't recommend anyone to do that.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. So you were fiscally sponsored. And what made you decide to go out on your own? Because fiscal sponsorship can sometimes last an organization decades.
Correct. I think for us, the biggest thing was the growth that we had experienced as an organization. We were formerly known as the West San Gabriel Bicycle Coalition. That's actually how this organization started. A group of concerned residents in the San Gabriel Valley organized a Facebook page and called it the West San Gabriel Valley Coalition of Bicyclists. Through a participatory internal planning process, we found that the name Bike San Gabriel Valley didn't really match or reflect the work that we were doing. It was too, you know, focused on bikes, where really our work was at the intersectionality of the climate crisis. In 2018, we rebranded and expanded our mission to be Active San Gabriel Valley, to really reflect all the work that we do.
For folks that aren't from LA, it might be hard to understand how biking is intersectional. So can you go into that a little bit about what it is to have access to transportation and how that intersects with biking? It sounds to me like a very logical move, but maybe you could go into that.
I'm a big proponent of systems change and looking at root causes. And just to provide a little bit more context and background around the communities that are in the San Gabriel Valley, we have a large immigrant population or foreign-born population. We have over 50% of folks who are foreign-born. The number of folks who bike to work is about 1%, which rivals that of city of LA. However, 35% of our sidewalk network is missing. There's, we would say, poor transit access in the area, and we have little to no infrastructure to support people walking, biking to and from popular destinations that include economic workforce opportunities. When we look at what it means for an individual to have economic opportunities, usually relying on how much access you have to a car, right? If you apply to a job, what's one of the first things they ask you for? A driver's license, insurance, can you get to and from this location, right? What do you need in order to buy a car or have access to a car? You need to have capital, right? If you're taking out a loan, you need to qualify for the loan. Sometimes, you know, those terms aren't favorable. And so really creating these car-centric, car culture communities in LA that we have right now really limits economic opportunity for folks, because the transit isn't reliable. You can't walk there safely. You can't bike there safely. And so it really limits people's economic opportunities, especially in areas like the cities of El Monte and South El Monte, where you don't have that much economic opportunity. So people have to travel, you know, far distances to get to where they work. So for example, my dad lives in South El Monte. And for the last 20-something years, he's had to commute all the way to Huntington Beach every day.
Wow.
Every day. And I can't tell you the impact that it's had on his life in terms of the things that he's missed out on because of all the times that he spends commuting. However, my dad doesn't have another opportunity locally to be able to do the same type of work or get paid the same that he does at this company that he currently works at. And that's a similar case for a lot of folks. And so for us, people who bike are just trying to get to a place of economic opportunity, trying to get to a library, trying to take their kids to school, trying to get to a community center, trying to access resources. And so when we don't have infrastructure, the public infrastructure to support them doing so, we're directly impacting their quality of life. And we really see this all connected. Some of us choose to bike because it's good for the environment. Some of us have the privilege of choosing.
Yep.
I want to bike because I want to keep my greenhouse gas emissions down. But some people don't have that option. And when you look at how many workforce opportunities are there in your community, what type of housing is available in your community? Is it affordable? How close is it to a park? How close is it to your kid's school? Do you have healthy food nearby? Like, all those things are connected, right? And they directly affect people's well-being and quality of life. We are all products of our environment.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. So you start off as a bike coalition, basically. You expand into all of these other areas because it matters so much and you can see the intersectionality there. Let's talk about how you begin to prepare to be independent of your fiscal sponsor. What do you do?
So I have a checklist of 100 things that you need to do in order to do that. At the start of it, the assessment of your current contracts and how amenable your funders will be for you to make that transition. A lot of the funding that you may be awarded comes with certain contractual obligations that you'll need to meet, regardless of whether you're with your fiscal sponsor or your new 501c3. So we had to do an assessment of our funders and how amenable they would be for us to make the transition from Community Partners, which was our fiscal sponsor, to our own 501c3. And so that's the first step, do an assessment.
So is an assessment a conversation with the funder, a review of the contract, all of the above? What happens in the assessment?
Correct. Conversations, multiple conversations with each individual funder around what are the requisites for them to feel comfortable to contractually move the contract from your fiscal sponsor over to your new 501c3. And so mm-hmm. they each came with a different set of obligations. Some could be as simple as long as you meet the insurance requirements of your own 501c3 and you have your articles of incorporation and all your other, 501c3 documentation, that's fine. That's enough for us to be able to move over the contract. Others, Allegheny County in particular, was a little bit more onerous. So they had a set of different requirements for us. So those got a little bit more detailed and intricate that required county council to get involved. So each individual funder came with its own set of requirements for us to be able to move over from being fiscally sponsored to becoming our own 501c3.
I am not surprised to hear that different funders wanted different things. That's not news, I think.
Yeah.
How did you make the go, no-go call on this? Because I can imagine that when you got to the assessment part, you were probably 80% of the way to that decision.
Yeah, I think after talking to all the funders, we then set out a realistic timeline for when we would transition and when it made most sense for the organization. And so we review things like, when do contracts end? When do contracts start? The beginning and end of the fiscal year, the term of the contracts that we had in place, how easy or difficult it would be to move contracts, what contracts needed different types of amendments. So we put that all together. And then ultimately we set out a 10-month timeline from the time that we just had these conversations with the funders to then move over to our new 501c3. So we gave folks plenty of notice. So it wasn't like we sprung it on them, hey, in 3 months, we're making this transition. I think the thing that was challenging or difficult was building out the infrastructure for the new organization as you're ending the infrastructure or some of the components for the fiscal sponsorship agreement. So essentially, it's like you're closing a business and you're opening one at the same mm-hmm. time.
Can you talk to me about the pros and cons of being out on your own?
So far, it's approaching 4 months and I love it. I love having that independence. I think it signals maturity to the funders. That's one of the things that we heard for foundations, that it signals maturity from the organization after being fiscally sponsored for so many years to be in a place where now you can become your own 501c3. I like the autonomy of that. We're still building the infrastructure for the organization, in particular the admin infrastructure for the organization. And in the meantime, that burden or that load of work falls on me. I've learned how to process payroll, but I hope not to be doing that anymore. So
I hope you don't have to do that anymore too. Did you lose anyone in the process?
In the transition, we did not lose anyone in the process. One of the things about Active SUV is that we do have this participatory decision-making process where we take input and feedback from folks into account for our decision-making. And so folks overwhelmingly were very supportive of making this transition. Everyone that was there with us as a fiscally sponsored project moved over to the new 501c3.
I assume you had to raise some more funds in order to make this transition from a fiscal sponsor to your own independent 501c3. How did you do that?
Luckily, all the funders that we had were amenable to making the transition from our fiscal sponsor over to our new 501c3. So we transferred existing contracts over to the new 501c3. And then most recently, we received support from the Weingott Foundation for unrestricted operating support for us to build our reserves and then also be able to implement our DEI work as well as take on anything else for the new 501c3. That's been really helpful. So I think the securing the existing funding was enough for us to be able to make that transition. Mm-hmm. And some of the work around having a certified public accountant, help with some of the other things that came out of our unrestricted funds. So we didn't necessarily have to raise new funds for it. Now, like one of the things with the fiscal sponsor is that they had a 50% admin fee that was then for them taking into account to pay for the back-end infrastructure that included rent, utilities, insurance, all that operating costs. Essentially, in effect, we're saving more money because the fiscal sponsor is no longer taking that 50% admin fee than using it for the back-end stuff that we typically don't see.
So it sounds like then, and this is a great lesson, I think, for other organizations, it really wasn't about, can we raise the funds to do this transition? It was looking at, okay, we have general operating support already. We will save 15%. So that goes into to help us with our additional costs. Plus, we know that all of our funders will move with us. Those three things all working together, you knew you could support.
That's correct. And I think it's really important to have the conversations with the funders. That'll tell you, that'll give you a pulse of where they're at, because it hasn't been, I think our experience is our experience. It won't be the same experience for everyone. Our experience is our experience, and our funders were really amenable to making the transition. Whereas some projects, their funders may not be as comfortable with that. It may go the other way, where the funder isn't comfortable with them making the transition to the to a 501c3 independent of the fiscal sponsor. So really, it's important to have that conversation with your existing funding sources to make sure that they're in agreement with you. Because if they're not, then you have to weigh the consequence of, like, we may lose this funding, and are we okay with forward without it? Will we be okay?
It sounds like you've also done a really good job when you budget and you fundraise around that budget of saying there needs to be funds to make the organization go. It's not just project-based fundraising and then you're left with an unfunded administration team.
Yeah, that's correct. With the admin team, yeah, making sure that we have multi-year projections around our budgeting and our staffing plans of what projects are upcoming. We keep a close eye on the request for proposals, making sure that we have a good sense of what's out there. Our thing is that we work in a specific geography. We work in Eastern Los Angeles County. And so we have a very good understanding of what opportunities are upcoming at the state level, what good opportunities are at the regional level, what good opportunities there are at the local level. And we work closely with cities to be able to submit proposals at times on behalf and collaboration with cities. And so we have a good understanding of what's coming up, what's on the docket, and how to best budget for future work and what our staffing needs are going to be.
So let's talk a little bit about how your organization runs. What do you think makes your team run well?
Yeah. One of the things that I think makes our team run really well is that, again, we are a nonprofit headquartered out of the city of El Monte, who is comprised of folks from the San Gabriel Valley. And so I think at the root of it, there's a big affinity for the place that we all grew up in and love for the mission, right? But to be able to be of service to others and to tackle the climate crisis, which we feel is the biggest threat to us all, right? And I think it's really special, Julian, that most of us, including myself, started off as a volunteer or intern. So I've started from a volunteer in 2014 to full-time staff in 2018 to later that year, in December 2018, becoming the executive director.
So be careful what you volunteer for.
Yeah, it may become your life's work. Most of us have graduated from volunteer or intern to full-time staff. And so I think that makes us, you know, truly unique. We have about 21 folks right now. And of those folks, most have started on as a volunteer or intern. So I think that really helps. And then in addition, some of the systems that have been set up for us is that we really try to mirror the approach that we want to see in our communities, that we want to see by government, that we want to see in other places or institutions. So we really take a collaborative approach to how we do the work. I mentioned earlier about our decision-making, having input and feedback from folks. Some of those things play out, for example, in meetings. We have an agenda that's structured for folks. We switch minute takers and facilitators, so sharing of power and delegation of who's doing what. And it's also good for professional development. We have a conversation around who's best suited for tasks. And so people are able to discuss, you know, in this meeting, who's the best person suited for this, depending on their workload or their week and what things they have going on. We have autonomy over schedules. No one's handed a schedule on Sunday evening or Monday morning. Here's what you're working. We have enough trust in the folks that work at Active SGB to give them autonomy over their schedules. We use Google Calendar and they'll mark on their Google Calendar what times and days they're working and at what times. And then we also provide people, even before the pandemic, before COVID-19, we offered folks the opportunity for remote work or telecommuting because we knew it was good for people's well-being as well as for the environment to keep their vehicle miles traveled down and all that. So even before COVID-19, we already provided autonomy over schedules, remote work. And then the other two things that I'll mention is that in terms of the culture, I think we've done a lot of work around building good work culture, healthy, positive work culture. And so for us, one of the things that we've implemented is Brené Brown's Braving. Braving, just each letter stands for something, right? So B for boundaries, R for responsibilities, A for accountability, Vault is V, integrity and non-judgmental and generosity. And we in our retreat and our conversations have had really frank discussions around what this means for us as a collective and then what this means for us as individuals. It's similar to like in community settings, right? Our community meetings, we want to have shared agreements around how we work with each other, how we resolve conflict, how we do the work. We've adopted these agreements according to us. So like some of the things haven't played out the way that we want to. So I'll give you an example. G, right? G is for generosity. And Brené Brown says, always assume good intentions. And we found that even if you always assume, Julie, if you say something mean to me and I didn't really like what you said to me, it's still going to make me feel a certain type of way. And so there's still that impact that's landed on me. And so this idea of intent versus impact, right, is really important to us. And so we've adopted and modified that, right? Yeah, assume good intentions. However, let's focus on impact.
But however, a mean comment is still a mean comment.
Yeah, impact versus intent, right? And so we've made it work for Active SGV. And so we've done that as a collective and as individuals, sharing so that everyone knows these are our group agreements. And all of this, I would say, is done in collaboration. So really the other thing is analyzing and setting up these systems in concert with your colleagues is really important. Because if it was just David saying, hey, y'all, this is what we're doing now, everybody, braving is it, right? And everyone's looking at each other, what is braving? Really taking this approach of building these systems together with folks as much as possible.
David, I think what's so significant about what you're doing and what you're saying and all of these things is that you are really taking care of your team as a resource. So I think sometimes especially in nonprofits that are doing movement building and are doing really close to the ground stuff versus, let's say, like an academic institution or a hospital or some of the bigger nonprofits we have in the sector, is that the burnout is a real risk to your business. Is that where some of this comes from?
Absolutely. I think, absolutely. I'm a big supporter of mental health and well-being. I think that if we're going to have any legitimacy, we need to also model the behavior that we want to see. And I believe that's particularly important of someone in a leadership position. I know it's cliche, but the people at Active SGV make Active SGV be what it is, right? Without them, what do we really have? And so that's really important to me. Self-care is important to me. Avoiding burnout is really important to me. Professional development, building next pipeline of leaders in or around this region is really important to me. Being able to do this type of work be of service to folks is really important to me. One of the things that's probably really frustrating to everyone is this nonprofit industrial complex and this sentiment of you should work out of the goodness of your heart. You should just be grateful for what you have. I think that nonprofits and people who work in public service provide tremendous value to society, to our communities. I just don't think, you know, that's caught up yet. Products have a lot of value, right? There's a lot of value placed on products. I don't think that same assessment or that same sentiment is placed on nonprofits and the type of work that we do.
Well, you're building that value, even if society's not there yet. Is there something you've done to adapt in the last 18 months to the changing environment? It sounds like you all were pretty set up to adapt to a global pandemic.
Yeah, we had the remote or the telecommuting systems put in place before. But I think for us, one of the things that we traditionally have focused on is direct engagement, because we recognized we needed to meet people where they were. And it's during COVID-19 lockdown, right? It's like, how do you meet people where they are if you're not supposed to meet people at all? How do you engage with folks? And again, our approach is multilingual, multicultural. And so we traditionally focus on direct engagement. I'm going to go to your house. I'm going to meet you at a community event. So now we utilize text banking. We send more emails, we're phone banking, we're calling people as much as people don't like to be called, right? We're sending out multilingual mailers, we're doing podcasts, we're continuing to do social media. We have webinars or virtual community meetings. We still do the door-to-door. We have community canvassing, community sites. We're doing pop-ups, all physically distant and secure. All of our team is vaccinated. And in addition to the direct service or some of the tactics, we also participate in food bank distributions. We do bicycle education and repair for folks. For us, the adaptation has been some around our community engagement and how we do it. Now we do all those things combined. We do all those things to really get the word out and do some participatory planning and engagement with community members. And some of that has yielded good results. We hosted a number of focus groups, did some pop-ups, did door-to-door, mailers, surveys, phone banking, text banking. around the development of an aquatic center in the San Gabriel Valley. It's called San Gabriel Valley Aquatic Center. Unfortunately, it looks like we're on our way to receiving full funding. We're about, I would say, 80% or 85% of the way there. It's in collaboration with LA County Department of Recreation, Parks and Rec, as well as Hacienda La Puente Unified School District. And we want to make sure that it continues to be community-driven, equitable, participatory planning and input process to get infrastructure that's going to meet the needs of this climate crisis.
Can you tell us about a mistake you've made and what you learned from it?
I would say one of the biggest mistakes that I've made is just taking on too much. We want to model the behavior that we want to see. And I think that there's been times where you just take on too much. And so I think, you know, that's really affected, you know, my ability to focus on big picture things or donor relations or whatever that may mean. And so I think that's been one of the mistakes that I've made. And I think for me, what I've learned about it is that we need to make that investment in those resources. It's not just me having to take on all this additional work, whereas I could have hired someone else or hired some type of support to be able to get that done. And so that's a learning that I think is ongoing with the job, right? Like things come up, you get new funding, you have to react. Sometimes there's a really short deadline on it. And so I think it's just a process of knowing how much work is feasible.
Yeah, that comes with experience, right? Where you know how long something is going to take. That's hard to get down. So what's the big idea moving forward and how do you think you'll get there?
I think the big idea for us is a 32-hour work week. And I want to be very specific about...
Tell us about this.
It's not the four-day work week, right? There's a four-day work week and then it's a 32-hour work week. So again, folks at Active SGB have autonomy over their schedules and the ability to do work remotely or in the office. And so for us, as of October 2021, we're implementing the 32-hour work week. And this is directly in response to the learnings from the pandemic. I feel to me, it's outlandish or just beyond me to think that we've all gone through this tremendous trauma of seeing others be ill, die, be near death, get sick, have to worry about that. And then to come back to something that's how we used to operate. It's just beyond me. And I think we cannot continue to operate in the same fashion that we were before. We have to learn because what did we see in the pandemic? Food insecurity was rampant. The ability for us to be able to deploy vaccines to everyone, regardless of insurance status. I love universal healthcare. Why don't we have that? And so I think for me, really, it's that focus on mental health and well-being, the gender equality, and also it's good for the environment for us to have a 32-hour work week. As a new dad, I really cherish and appreciate all the time that I get to spend with my kid. And I think for everyone else, I recognize that our lives are much more than the work that we do. I love the work that we do. I'm super passionate about it. However, there's a consequence of working 60, 70 hours or commuting 5 hours a day. That's taking away from your interests, your own personal health and well-being, and how sustainable that is.
Staff likes it so far?
Yes. Haven't heard otherwise.
They got 5 days to tell you.
Yeah. And then this week, yesterday, we recognized Indigenous Peoples Day and they'll work a total of 24 hours. We'll work a total of 24.
Right. David, I'm going to ask you to give a tip for someone who might be at a nonprofit who wants to have more government relationships to start working with cities more or improve those relationships.
I would say get to know city agencies and staff. That's one of the first things, right? Because you have elected decision makers, but ultimately it's like staff that makes things happen. So get to know those folks. I would say organize in and around your community. So if you're interested in working in a respective community, please get to know the community. We do not advertise or like when people from other communities come in and try to do work without really knowing the community or having a good understanding. So as a place-based organization, you know, the San Gabriel Valley is the place where we all have a lot of affinity towards. So yeah, get to know agency staff, get to know the community, get familiar with the needs. And that's one way to be able to work with government.
I want to give you a chance to give a general tip for someone in your position.
Yes. My tip for someone in my position would be to develop standard operating procedures. When I became executive director, I was about 30 years old. So I consider myself a pretty young executive director. And for me, I'm looking for learning toward other folks that I admire and I've worked with. Rudy Espinoza, Dr. Dartini Sforza was at the Social Justice Learning Institute. And he actually, this is one of his big tips, is to create standard operating procedures. And I can't tell you how much of a difference that makes, just because when I started, there was about 5 or 6 of us at the organization. And so now it's about 21 of us. So having to, you know, explain how we do things to each incoming person as you're growing a team becomes quite time consuming. We've developed a menu of standard operating procedures in terms of how we do community engagement, how we do text banking, how we do social media, how we request time off. It's just, it runs a list of how we do things. And so it's important for people and for the organization to write down how we do our work, because then it makes it easier for folks to follow, provides clarity. I think it provides professional development for folks that are incoming that may not have that skill set or been exposed to that type of work in the past, and it provides autonomy. But then also for us, we do provide or build in check-ins for folks to be able to ask questions if something's not clear on the standard operating procedure. And it's not just me writing it. Again, it's a collective process of different folks writing these standard operating procedures. So I would say that figure out, you know, how to make sure that each position is able to clearly define or describe the tasks that they're conducting, so you can then easily translate that to other folks, right? Because then you're going to be inundated. How do I do this? Where do I get that? How do I log in here? Where's this? Right. And so that's really important. And then the other tip, Julia, that I'll just say really quick is continue to read. I think that's one of the first things, that I just kept doing and actually did more as a new executive director, is just reading everything I get hands on. 7 Habits of Effective Leadership, Surprising Science of Meetings, some book called Power, How to Do Nothing, The Body Keeps the Score. Just continue to read, I think, is really important. Now, with the 16-month-old, I don't get to read as much as I'd like to, but I definitely recommend to continue reading.
Excellent. We'll get some book recommendations and put them up on the website when this comes out. And David, thank you so much for your time. It was really great to talk to you and exciting to learn from you.
Thank you, Julia. I really appreciate it.
We have a request for you, dear listeners.
I'm hoping that if you enjoy How We Run, that you will go and leave a review for us. Your review allows others to find us, and that's a good thing, because the more people that listen, the more impact we can have on the sector, and that we can bring about positive change for other nonprofits that are out there. So if you like what you're listening to, please leave us a review.
If you want to be a guest on the show, you think you have a good story and you want to share, you can email us at info@goodwaysinc.com.